0923, Dr. Richard Jackson versus David and Carolyn Axelrad.
May this court be referring to your ruling between our petition number 5 and 0.
May it please the court. The first issue which I would like to address today is whether or not the Court of Appeals in this case used the proper standard in measuring the sufficiency of the evidence. This court, going back to Washington versus Cook, City of Fort Worth versus Zimlin, Osterberg versus Pekka, Walmart versus Sturgis, and most recently in Romero versus KPH Consolidated, has held that in measuring the sufficiency of the evidence, the court must measure it against the charge that was actually submitted as opposed to some unknown law if there is no objection to the charge. In this case, the trial court submitted, with respect to the contributory negligence of Dr. Axelrad, the PJC definitions of negligence, ordinary care, and proximate cause. That is, what would a reasonable person under the same or similar circumstances have done? At the charge conference, plaintiff's counsel was asked whether or not there were any objections to the charge and indicated in Volume 6 of the Reporter's Record, page 224, there were no objections. So the jury was charged as far as the contributory negligence of Dr. Axelrad, as far as the ordinary care of an ordinary prudent person under the same or similar circumstances. Now, the Court of Appeals in this case, however, when they were measuring the sufficiency of the evidence, didn't measure it against the charge that was actually submitted.
Well, they say they're just looking at whether there's evidence.
I'm sorry?
They say they're just looking whether there's evidence. In other words, they say, like Fletcher, no question a stockbroker has duties to your client, and they're just saying, but the fact that I didn't find out if she was senile or not is not part of that, so the fact that I didn't ask her is not evidence. They say they're not.
Okay.
It's just a regular sentence. No question a patient has a duty to disclose something to doctors.
Sure. And the difference between this case and the Fletcher case, in Fletcher, if you look, there really wasn't, as I read the case, any dispute about the duty. The question was whether or not there were facts that would trigger the duty.
But that's the same. Why isn't that the same question here?
Because in this case, there was a question about what was the duty. In fact, in Osterberg versus Pekka, this court said, if the trial judge must resolve a legal issue before the jury could properly perform its fact-finding, the party must lodge an objection in time for the trial court to make an appropriate ruling without having to order a new trial. And if this court recall in the Osterberg case, the question was, it was an election case, whether or not there must be strict compliance with the statute regarding filing of financial disclosures. And the jury was charged on that. And the jury found against the appellant. And on appeal, the appellant said, well, yeah, there was this duty, but we believe there was a lesser duty. That is, if there was substantial compliance, there doesn't have to be exact compliance, but if there was substantial compliance, then we're okay. And this court in the Osterberg case said, well, substantial compliance is a lesser duty. If you wanted to measure the evidence against that, then you should have objected and you should have requested an issue be submitted on that ground. It's the same in this case. The argument by Dr. Jackson was that the duty governed a patient was the duty of general ordinary care. What a reasonable person would have done. Dr. Axelrad, on the other hand, was saying, no, it's a very limited, much more narrow duty. And if that was their position, if they were going to take that position, then we believe that they had an obligation to object at the time the case was being submitted to the charge, to the jury, and not wait until there's been an adverse verdict, and then for the first time, after the jury's been discharged, the verdict's been received.
But what would that charge look like?
Well, that's one of the problems with the new...
I mean, it would be very complicated to explain in all details for every case what a patient has to disclose and how and all of that. I mean, that's that's not really, this is really a no evidence case, isn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the first issue that's got to be addressed is...
I mean, it's one thing. You're saying, Osterber, sure. I mean, if you need to tell the jury, are you looking for clear and convincing evidence or just regular old preponderance evidence? Do you need to tell the jury that?
Well, that was Romero.
But if the jury is just, you know, did the patient contribute to this debacle by not saying where it hurt, and then everybody argues to the jury whether they did or didn't, why isn't this charge good enough?
Because if you look at this court's decision in other cases where the duty is something other than the duty of ordinary care, for example, in premises liability cases, in negligent undertaking cases, where you have a child involved, where you have a higher standard of care, this court has said you've got to instruct the jury on what the duty is so the jury can measure the evidence against what the duty is on the part of the defendant or the part of the plaintiff. And the way to do this is not just to submit a general duty question and then say, well, we're going to measure the evidence against some undefined, unsubmitted duty that's out there. That was the argument in Osterberg, and that was the argument that was rejected by this court in the Osterberg case. We believe that this court has, for the last at least 20 to 30 years, and we believe it's a very well-reasoned, sound rule required that if a party is claiming a duty that is different from the ordinary care in a tort case, you must request the jury to be instructed on that so the jury will know how to measure the evidence. Otherwise, the jury is measuring the evidence against something that's not before them. And likewise, when the Court of Appeals is reviewing the evidence, certainly the Court of Appeals ought to review the evidence in light of what was actually submitted to the jury. And if a party is arguing some deviation from that duty, based upon a particular facts or particular area of the law, then they have an obligation to speak up and not wait until they receive an adverse judgment. Now, in this case, even if there had been an objection by Dr. Axelrad, we believe that the new duty that's urged by Dr. Axelrad and adopted by the Court of Appeals is unworkable and conflicts with existing law from this court. Over 14 years ago, or about 14 years ago, this court in Elbor versus Smith held that there is a common law duty on the part of a patient to cooperate with a doctor in the care and treatment. Of course, that involved compliance with instructions, which is not what is involved in this case. Granted, it was a different issue. In Eisner versus Watson, the Beaumont Court of Appeals was faced with this particular issue, and that is whether or not Ms. Watson had given a full and complete history. There was an instruction that was given to the jury on that, whether or not she gave a full and complete history. Unfortunately, in that case, as we pointed out in our briefs, the jury answered no, and so the Court of Appeals never was really confronted with the full extent and the scope of that duty. Now, the majority...
Well, the problem I have with that is that cooperating with the doctor is something that I think I understand. Maybe I don't, but at least I feel like I understand. But if you then say, and that means volunteering that the pain started on the lower left side. See, this is just me, but if I were going to the hospital and I was in excruciating pain, it wouldn't occur to me that it mattered how it started or exactly the way that it moved or any of those things. And all I'm thinking about is this hurts like the dickens and what can be done. And so I wonder if a jury really knows what an ordinary person does in those circumstances without being given some parameters that you have to do this much or this much.
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is, again, I think the situation we're in today is dramatically different from the situation we're in 20 or 30 years ago. If you look at all the cases that are cited by the majority, I think all but one were decided in the 80s or the 70s. And I think there may have been one in the 60s. But all of them were pretty much 20 to 30 years old. And we know that with respect to healthcare and healthcare consumers, what was true 20 years ago is totally different than is what is true today. 20 years ago, you pretty much went to the doctor, you listened to what he or she said, and you did. However, now we are in an information age, and I didn't cite it in a brief, but I'll give you the cite. There was a study done, and it's founded by the Pew Institute, PEW, and it's found at www.pewinternet.org. And what it says is that, and it was in 2002, that 80% now of all adults who go to seek medical care treatment do their own research before they go. 93 million Americans do this. And they say that they go online to become informed and prepare for appointments and surgeries. And they report that 73% of them say their health care services have been improved as a result of them being more on the same level as the doctor or the health care provider that's providing this information.
That's all fine if you have the time to do that, but that still doesn't answer the question. What do you do if you're in excruciating pain and you go, I hurt? You know, well, then, what is your duty, if any at all?
Then the duty is what a person under the same or similar circumstances would have done, which is what was argued by the dissent in this case.
But for instance, I mean, my concern is the jury being confused. You should have told me that somebody told you to get a colonoscopy back in 1994. Well, I mean, the doctors tell everybody over 50, all males, to get a colonoscopy. What possible grounds for negligence could there be that I forgot to tell Dr. Jackson that somebody told me to get a colonoscopy in 94?
Well, the relevance and the possible grounds is the question is whether or not there has been a history of bowel disorders. And there
what
was testing.
What is a recommendation to get a colonoscopy?
Well, actually, there had been a treatment of practice.
When I do my research on the internet, they say everybody over 50. They say I'm supposed to have done one. Now, why is that? And isn't that going to confuse jurors?
No, we had expert testimony, Your Honor, Justice Brister. Their own expert, Dr. Kenner, testified that a recommendation of a colonoscopy would have been useful to know in making a diagnosis of diverticulitis. Dr. Saleem.
How does the patient know that?
Well, because the patient in this case, first off.
Of course, he was a doctor.
He was a doctor. He was an MD. But number two, he was asked by Dr. Jackson, can you tell me what's happened since your last appointment? What have you done? What has happened to you since the last appointment? And this, again, was within 2 or 3 years of this event taking place. I mean, this is a fairly old case, even though it sounds, 97 or whatever. It was these events that were the colonoscopy and things like that took place were in 1994. So there was a question where Dr. Axelrad was asked, what has happened since your last appointment? None of this was revealed. He revealed it to Dr. Dobbs, who was the gastroenterologist. He revealed it to Dr. Reardon, who was the surgeon, but he didn't reveal it to Dr. Jackson. Dr. Jackson, Dr. Saleem, and Dr. Kenner all testified that a history of bowel problems would have been important in making your differential diagnosis.
Is there evidence, I was not clear from the briefs, is there evidence that Dr. Jackson should have asked Dr. Axelrad directly where the pain initiated or whether he had this history of bowel problems?
The only evidence, Justice Hecht, regarding that was Dr. Jackson asked Dr. Axelrad, tell me what's happening to you.
But was there like expert testimony that the duty of care in this case is to ask directly, point blank?
I don't recall there being any expert who said that specific question should have been asked right. of Dr. Axelrad.
Didn't seem to be.
So there were general questions, what's happening to you, and what has happened since the last visit that we had together. Those two questions, we believe, certainly at a minimum, would have elicited the history of bowel problems that had taken place since the last visit. We have three experts testifying that if you have a history of bowel problems, that is significant with respect to the differential diagnosis of diverticulitis and would have moved that up on the differential diagnosis list. So we believe that based on the evidence that was presented, even if you adopt the more limited rule by the majority, or if you go with the general rule by the dissent, we believe there was clearly sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding of contributory negligence.
Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Darren Walker will present argument for response.
With the court's indulgence, I'll take the two issues in reverse order, beginning with the substantive issue. There were some particularities of the record that I'd like to clear up. First of all, there was no testimony that Dr. Jackson specifically asked Dr. Axelrod, what's happened since the last time you were here. Dr. Jackson was asked, typically when you're seeing a patient, do you ask what's happened? And Dr. Jackson said, yes, typically I ask what's happened since the last time I saw them. However, in this case, Dr. Jackson was specifically asked and specifically testified on two occasions as to the exact conversations he had with Dr. Axelrod, and that question was not given. I would submit that when a person testifies to a specific conversation and gives the details of it, it is not reasonable to infer from his testimony that I would typically ask this question that he did when his specific testimony did not recount that.
Well, but your client said I told him it started in the lower left quadrant.
That's true.
So it really doesn't matter. If we infer everything in favor of the jury's judgment, it really doesn't matter whether the Dr. Jackson asked him or not because your client said I told him that.
Well, except that I don't believe the standard of review would permit the court to draw conflicting inferences that would give conflicting facts.
I saw that, but that doesn't make sense. Let me give you a hypothetical. Wife says, honey, did you send that package I asked you to send? Husband, long pause. Sure did. Now, could a jury infer from that that husband is lying?
Oh, certainly.
Could a jury also infer that husband is telling the lie because husband knew he was supposed to mail?
Certainly.
So there's one thing. Why isn't this the same as that? If the jury could infer that Axelrod was lying when he said, I told him there was left lower quadrant pain when we talked on the phone, couldn't a jury infer from that 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 means Axelrod also knew he was supposed to do that?
Well, when I said that the standard of review does not permit conflicting inferences, what I meant was this. The jury could have believed one of two facts occurred. Either Dr. Axelrod said he had left lower quadrant pain, or he didn't. And if the jury believes that he actually told Dr. Jackson, I have left lower quadrant pain, that cannot be, his failure to tell him that cannot be a basis for the contributing finding. So the jury had to, in order for that to have been the basis for the jury's
finding. What I'm saying is, though, if he says it at trial, couldn't the jury decide, number one, we don't believe you, you didn't tell him back then, and number two, the reason you're saying that at trial is because you now acknowledge you should have said it back then?
Well, I would argue that the reasonable inference would be that Dr. Axelrod learned during trial or in preparation for the trial that it was important if Dr. Jackson had known that there was left lower quadrant pain, Dr. Jackson was negligent. And all the experts basically said that that was a classic sign. So the inference, and in fact, in the closing argument, that's exactly what defendant argued was, he didn't tell Dr. Jackson this at the time. He admitted in his deposition he didn't tell him, but now he's talked to Dr. Kanner, his expert, and Dr. Kanner's told him that, boy, that's really important if you told him that. So now he's changed his story. So I would argue that because of the direction of the inference, that the only reasonable inference from the change in testimony is that Dr. Axelrod didn't learn until sometime as he was preparing between his deposition and trial that was an important fact. Now,
the dissent makes reference to new duties imposed on doctors by the opinion written by the majority. Can you comment on that, please?
There are no new duties on the doctor. The doctor only has the duty to exercise reasonable prudence to ask whatever questions a reasonably prudent doctor would ask. The question that the majority decided was what is the patient's duty to give information to the doctor. So, for example, if there were a situation where a reasonably prudent doctor would not ask about a particular fact, but the patient had no reason to know it was important either, then neither party would be negligent. The doctor exercised reasonable prudence, so did the patient. The problem was that this case just fell through the cracks. There's a bad result, but nobody's negligent. No one's negligent.
Was the submission proper or not?
Well, I believe it was, and here's why. The submission was not erroneous. The submission did not tell the jury something that was wrong, like in Osterberg versus Pica and so forth. It didn't say the burden of proof is clear and convincing when it should have been preponderance. It didn't give the wrong definition of malice. It was simply broad. So under that broad submission, this court can review the evidence to say, is there any evidence to support the negligence finding? And if the only evidence in the record demonstrates omissions that the plaintiff had no duty to act, then there was no evidence of a breach of any duty that the plaintiff owed. I cannot distinguish this case from Fletcher. I think this case is virtually identical to Fletcher. Now, if the charge had said a patient has a duty to take care of himself before he gets sick, and if the patient doesn't take good care of his health, that's contributory negligence. If the charge had said that, well, we know that's not the law, but if the charge had said that and we hadn't objected, then evidence of that could support the finding. But the charge didn't say that. The charge wasn't wrong. It was just broad. In which case...
But if the only duty is narrow, if that's the only duty, then isn't there a problem with the charge that you can raise by no evidence?
There is, we cannot complain of charge error, okay, because the charge was submitted and it was not objected to. However, the evidence still has to support the finding. Now, let me give you, there was a consequence to our failure to object, and here's what it was. I personally believe that the reason the jury found Dr. Axelrod negligent was because he didn't take good enough care of himself in the 10 years before this event occurred. That was the main thrust of the argument. Now, if we had requested a limited instruction, then the jury might have answered that question knowing we wouldn't be here. But because it was a broad form submission, our burden is to show that there's no evidence to support a breach of duty under any theory. And so we have to show not only that there's no evidence that would support a breach of duty on the failure to reveal the prior proctoscopy, but we also have to show that there's no evidence to support a breach of duty for failure to show failure to divulge the left lower quadrant pain. If the charge had been more narrowly constructed or more detailed, perhaps the jury would have answered some of those questions no, and we wouldn't have to fight that battle.
Let me test this just for a second. If at the time of the charge conference, you believe there's no evidence of any breach of the patient's duty whatsoever, then shouldn't there have been an objection to submission at all of the comparative?
I don't believe that the rules of procedure require an objection to the charge to raise a no evidence point. And in fact, oftentimes, in a more traditional sense, oftentimes I think, you know, if the jury finds against us, I think we can probably reverse it. But go ahead and let them submit it, because if the jury answers it in our favor, then we have an even easier appellate burden. And the rules specifically say we don't have to object to
the
charge.
If you, assuming you're right on the no evidence point, and you convince the trial court at the time of the charge that you were right, then it saves a new trial. If he had submitted only the defendants in that question, we wouldn't be here.
That's true. I mean, I'm not saying that there is not a negative consequence to the failure to put in instructions limiting the duty or whatnot. All I'm saying is that under the rules of procedure, we can raise a no evidence point, and part of the evidence that is required is evidence that Dr. Axelrod breached some duty that he owed, and this court can look at the evidence and ask itself, does any of this evidence support a breach of any legal duty, just like in Fletcher?
Out of curiosity, if the answer is no, like the Court of Appeals thought, why aren't you entitled to rendition?
Well, because the jury didn't reach the damages question, and so we don't have a damages finding. So I can't ask the court to render judgment for me. We have to retry the case.
Because it was conditioned that way.
Right.
And so why wouldn't there? Well, why didn't you object to the conditioning then?
Well, I anticipate that you'd ask this question, and so my answer is it was not a conscious decision made strategically in light of this whole body of law. We didn't object, which is why we raised a no evidence rather than a charge error. We have consequences from our failure to object, one of which is we can't get a rendition, another of which is we have to deal with all the possible theories of negligence. But the fact of the matter remains that there's no evidence from which a jury, even if it had been charged properly, a jury could not have answered the question yes under this record. There just simply isn't any evidence that Dr. Axelrod had any appreciation that these two things were important. Dr. Jackson points out, I wanted to answer Justice Heck's question about whether there was any evidence that Dr. Jackson should have asked this specific question. Dr. Jackson's expert, Dr. Saleem, at volume 4, page 15, was talking about how a doctor learns about and how he goes about diagnosing. And he was asked, what if a patient comes in and says they have abdominal pain? Dr. Saleem said, well, then I want to know some more things. I want to know X, Y, Z. And he specifically said, I want to know more details, including, does the pain move from one part to another? So Dr. Jackson's own expert said that if a patient came in and said, I have abdominal pain, he would ask, is this pain moving around? There's no evidence, and that's at 4, reports record, page 15. So there was some evidence that a reasonably prudent physician would have asked about whether the pain was moving around. The reliance on Dr. Axelrod's medical training is a little bit overblown because Dr. Axelrod did testify at one point that he had worked in ERs for about 5 years in the 70s. That was in the context of he was being questioned about his own mistaken belief that he had rebound when he first called Dr. Jackson. And he was asked, now, laying on hands is not really something you do as a psychiatrist. He said, that's right. And then he was asked, in fact, that's really not something you've done since you got out of medical school. And he said, well, no, that's not really true. For 5 years right after I got out of medical school, I worked in an ER, so I have examined abdomens. That is not any evidence relating to any knowledge about diverticulitis or specifically the importance of left lower quadrant pain onset of diverticulitis. To infer from that that Dr. Axelrod knew or should have known that it was important where the pain began versus where it was at the time he presented would be akin to the argument that was made in Broders versus Heist that, well, this person's a doctor, they've been to medical school, and so they can testify about medical things. And this court said, no, there has to be some evidence that they know what they're talking about with respect to this specific issue. And there's nothing in the record that indicates that at the time Dr. Axelrod knew anything about the importance of left lower quadrant pain. At one point he was asked, now, you are aware, at least I hope you're aware by now, that left lower quadrant pain is a classic symptom of diverticulitis. And Dr. Axelrod said yes, because by this time, Dr. Axelrod had been through this terrible experience, had talked to all these doctors, had talked to his expert. He gained an education in preparing for this case. And a lot of his testimony that was sort of touching upon certain topics that were medical in nature was testimony given at trial with the benefit of the experience of preparing for trial. But there is no testimony that Dr. Axelrod knew anything about the importance of left lower quadrant pain at the time that he presented to Dr. Jackson.
Let me ask you, apart from the preservation issues that you've talked about, if you think that one thing the jury thought was that his failure to take proper care of himself over an extended period was really ascribable to him as responsibility for what happened, doesn't that argue for a more detailed description of the duty in the charge? And if you think so, what should it be?
Well, I certainly, in a case such as, in a case where there is some evidence of both a valid theory and an invalid theory, there should be something in the charge. Otherwise, without objection, the charge will be, the verdict will be sustained if there is evidence to support the jury's finding on any theory. And that's, we've taken on that burden in this case. We've attacked every theory they raised and showed that there was no evidence that the jury could have found under any theory. But yes, if there had been evidence, for example, that Dr. Axelrod knew at the time that it was very important that he reveal left lower quadrant pain, and he didn't, then we would be suffering from the fact that we did not instruct the jury, don't consider his prior course of treating, you know, taking care of himself as negligence, because the jury could have actually answered yes based on that. The jury could have believed, well, yeah, even though he knew it was important, he was in so much pain that really wasn't negligent. But we would still have to defend, assuming the jury had found on the valid theory. So yes, it would be prudent in a case where the evidence will support a valid and an invalid theory to instruct the jury.
About what?
Well, about that it is not a patient's, it cannot be considered contributory negligence that the patient failed to take care of himself prior to presenting to the doctor. And of course, it would be a case by case. You would have to craft such instructions depending upon what the evidence was in the case. But in this case, there simply is no evidence that would support the finding on any theory in the record. And that's why the failure to object does not prohibit this court from affirming what the Court of Appeals did or show that the Court of Appeals was wrong. Very briefly, on the issue of proximate cause, Dr. Jackson's brief paraphrases what the testimony was. We would encourage the court to actually go to the record where Dr. Jackson cites and read what the actual testimony was, and here's why. Dr. Jackson says in his brief that there was testimony that if we knew about his longstanding bowel problems, we may have diagnosed diverticulitis. But it was undisputed that Dr. Jackson was told by Mrs. Axelrod before he prescribed the enema that Dr. Axelrod had weird bowel habits. It wasn't the failure to explain his unusual bowel habits that was the problem. The alleged negligence was the failure to talk about the prior proctoscope. And there was no testimony in the record that if I had known about the prior proctoscope, I probably would not have prescribed the enema. And in fact, what the evidence showed, and there are several places where Dr. Jackson said, if I knew then what I know now, I would have done it differently. If I knew he had diverticulitis, I would have done it differently. But he never said, if I knew he had had that prior proctoscope, I would have done this, and that would have prevented the injury. Or if I knew that his pain started in the left lower quadrant, I would have done this, and then his result would have been different. There was never any specific testimony with respect to these two pieces of information where Dr. Jackson said, knowing that probably would have changed the result. By contrast, Dr. Jackson testified several times with respect to several different pieces of information that if I had known that, I wouldn't have prescribed the enema. At page 29 of volume 6, He said, if I had known he had rebound, I would not have ordered an enema. At page 279 through 80 of volume 3, he said, if I had known he had an elevated white blood cell count and abdominal pain, I would probably not have given an enema. But he never said anything like that. I apologize. May I finish?
Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Three points I'd like to make. First is regarding their objection to the charge and how the sufficiency of the evidence is to be reviewed. As I understood counsel's statement is, a litigant can make no objections regarding what is the proper legal duty. Let the charge be submitted in any form or fashion, and then when it comes time to review the sufficiency of the evidence, they can say we're going to discard the charge. Rather, we're going to look at what the actual duties are. If that is the case, first off, why are we instructing the juries as far as duties anyway to begin with?
Well, because, I mean, the broad form, I mean, you know, we got tired of instructing the jury, you know, a defendant fails to use ordinary care, if they fail to keep a proper lookout, fail to yield right away, fail to do this, fail to do that, fail to do the other thing. We just say, well, they fail to act like an ordinarily prudent person, let you all argue it. And so why isn't this fine for that same purpose? We could get a very complicated thing about all the possible things that patients might do wrong. But isn't it easier just to say, did the patient act like an ordinary prudent person, and let y'all argue?
Well, then why has this court on numerous occasions said where the duty is something other than a prudent person, you instruct the jury on what the duty is? And the question in Osterberg versus Pekka, this court said it is the court's charge, not some other unidentified law that measures the sufficiency of the evidence when the opposing party fails to object to the charge. So this court has said 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that it is the court's charge that governs the sufficiency, not some other unidentified law that governs the measure of the sufficiency of the evidence when there has been no objection.
But I thought his argument was, if there's no evidence in the record of any omission for which there's a duty to act, then what difference does it make how broadly the duty is defined in the charge?
Well, he's trying to identify with the Fletcher case. And in Fletcher, I don't believe there was a dispute as to what the duty was. In this case, as in Osterberg, there was a dispute as to what the duty was as to act. We took the position it was a broad duty on their part to act. They took the position it was very narrow. And I believe what Osterberg says is where there is a duty, where there is a dispute, a legal dispute as to the duty, then the trial court must resolve a legal issue before the jury could properly perform its fact-finding, and a party must lodge an objection in time for the trial court to make the appropriate ruling without having to order a new trial. That's on page number 55 of Osterberg versus Pekka. And so we believe this case falls squarely within that. Number two, standard of review. We want, and you hear their arguments, it's like, well, you know, this is really what the jury meant, or this is really what they were thinking. That isn't consistent with the standard of review. If there is a reasonable inference, it must be indulged in our favor. So, for example, when Dr. Jackson said, my routine practice was to ask, what has changed since the last appointment? And that's the way I normally conduct myself. Under the standard of review, all reasonable inferences must be indulged in the jury's favor. And applying the appropriate standard review then, this court and the Court of Appeals should have done it, should have indulged, well, if that's his routine, then we're going to have to assume that that's what was asked of Dr. Axelrad, what has changed since last time, and that he did not disclose all the medical history that had occurred since then, which was undisputed, and that therefore he failed to respond to a specific inquiry. Also, with respect to the lower left quadrant pain, as counsel said, there was testimony in Volume 3, page 133, by Dr. Axelrad that he knew lower left pain was a classic symptom of diverticulitis. Now, granted in the record, there is no indication about when that knowledge was obtained or was acquired. That is true. We don't know if it was at the trial, certainly before the trial, or if he knew that 10 years before the trial. It is simply absent. But given the standard review, all inferences must be indulged in favor of Dr. Jackson. We believe there is sufficient evidence to support the jury's question.
Chief, may I ask one question?
Yes, sir.
Would you address briefly counsel's statement that there is no evidence of causation?
We believe there clearly is evidence of causation.
Will you just stand on your record references on that, or is there anything beyond that?
The record references.
In your brief.
In our brief, and I can give.
If you're just standing on those.
We will stand on those. We believe there is clearly evidence of causation.
Thank you. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.